Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. We're broadcasting today from the Sacramento studio of KQED. Matthew Cates stepped down last week as head of the state's prison system. He led that sometimes troubled system for 4 years, contending with prison overcrowding, tough labor negotiations with the state's prison guards, federal takeover of prisoner health care, and the newly mandated effort known as realignment, which shifts some state prisoners back to county jails. He leaves his last job to take over the California State Association of Counties, where, ironically, he'll have to deal with some of these issues now being put before the counties. Matthew Cates, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Dave. Thank you.
We seem to be in a kind of time of change with state corrections from this time of overwhelming overcrowded and in a policy of putting more people behind bars. So now we see these changes, for example, in the three strikes law in the last election. Are we at a kind of turning point moment in how we view corrections and the prisons in this state?
You know, I think it seems like that, but in actuality, we've been taking on a shift in our policies. I think over the last 4 or 5 years, we recognized under the last administration that crowding was making everything impossible to do in the prisons effectively. And so the policies began to shift then. But the major change has certainly been over the last 2 years. And so, yeah, I think it's a definite sea change in public safety in California.
What do you make of that as far as just from a someone who's observed the state for some time and looks at the way in which the state has voted in the past? Striking the amount of support, for example, in changing the three strikes law in particular. It passed with, what, something like 68-69% of the vote. What do you think's behind that?
Well, I think it's a confluence of things. There's a big piece of this that's fiscal. People recognize that prisons are expensive and that they're not always effective in permanently incapacitating someone because people do come back into society. And I think that to the extent that the citizens of California believe that only the dangerous people should be in prison rather than those, you know, we're just mad at, they're willing to make changes and try to get that equation right. And I think that's what we're seeing.
And yet at the same time, there was a reaffirmation of the death penalty. Do you see those as being contradictory? What do you make of that sort of result from this past election?
Well, I guess I'm not surprised. As I recall, California passed three strikes and its first loosening of medical marijuana laws the same year. So we're a little bipolar as a people, it seems. I think that we are seeing a shift. It just seems to me people were ready to take a second look at those guys whose last offense was minor that ended up getting them a long sentence, but not ready to take on this issue of the death penalty quite yet.
I wanted to ask you more about the change in three strikes, in part because part of what you also now have an affiliation with is as a fellow is at the Stanford Law School. And the Stanford Law School played a direct role in the change in three strikes. And I'm interested in how you view that with public policy generally in corrections, but also in your new role in the counties with a academic-led, in many ways, effort to change public policy. Do you think that there's more that can come from that in that way in the future?
I do. I think that California policymakers as a whole are getting more focused on what the evidence says about crime and punishment and a little less focused, at least for right now, on headlines and a little of the hyperbole that used to surround crime issues in California. I think that the universities, both at Stanford, where I'm a fellow, and some of the other major universities are making some headway there. And it's my hope that over time we continue to see that trend because it really has, I think, and will make a significant difference in reducing crime if we can really focus in on what the evidence says about public safety as opposed to just reacting to headlines.
And what is that evidence? I mean, what's the central fact, I guess, about what we know?
Well, the big shift has been we have very good data now about who is dangerous and who is likely to commit a new crime in the future and who is not. It's been a couple of years now that California and the prison system first established a truly a proven risk instrument, one that had been validated on California's prison population, and we're now able to fairly accurately determine who's high risk, who's medium, and who's low risk. And I think that's been a significant step forward.
And what are the factors? I mean, what determines that?
The biggest factor is age. So the older we get, the less likely it is that we're going to commit crime, especially violent crime. And I think this is what's part of what's led to this three strikes review, as we have people that are, well, in the prison system, we would say they are aging out of their criminality. Hmm. We just don't see very many people over age 45 committing violent crimes. Younger people are more impulsive. You know, the other thing that's interesting is that a big factor is how young you are when you commit your first crime. That says a lot about a person's future. And I think that has been on policymakers' minds as they think about how we should be investing in our schools and how we should be investing in our juvenile system.
So which end of the spectrum does that play out? When you say age of first crime is critical, is it that the younger you commit the crime, the more likely you are to continue? Or what do we know?
Exactly right. What you see is if you commit your first crime at a young age, if you commit multiple crimes as a juvenile, that's a very strong indicator of that you're going to commit crimes, including violent crimes, as an adult. And so from the perspective of criminologists, they would say invest in the youth, children, and try to break that cycle. That's the best way as far as effectiveness and efficiency.
Are we doing that?
Well, we are. We're investing more resources in juvenile programs in the counties. We're seeing a strong investment in what was called SB 81, where the state shifted some funding to county governments to build newer juvenile facilities that were appropriate, where rehabilitation could take place. And probation chiefs across the state are doing a much better job of intervening and working with county healthcare officials and protective services to try to make a difference in those kids' lives.
You know, it seems in some ways so almost obvious that the older the criminal, the less likely he or she is to participate in violent crime. The younger, the more likely they're going to have that pattern will continue. Did we not know those things before? I mean, why did it take until the year 2012 to figure that out?
Well, They've had studies that said, you know, we think this factor is important or that factor is important, but it's only been in the last 5 or 10 years that states have taken those factors and working with academics at UC Irvine, at Berkeley, at Stanford, and others to put it all together and say, now, if we applied these factors to a cohort of people in prison and we had done that 3 years ago, what would the results have been? And now we have this validation that, yes, we can – they're strong. These indicators actually work, which then allow policymakers, legislators, and those kinds of folks to make better decisions.
And it used to be that we would just sort of release or parole people based on how long they'd served as opposed to those kinds of very specific criteria?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And not only when we paroled them from prison, but also – what sanction would we impose if they violated parole?
Yeah.
So if you're on parole and you have what we call a dirty test, so you've used whatever your drug of choice is again, that violates the terms of your parole, we can do a couple things. We can put you in a program. We can put you on house arrest, or we can send you back to prison. And about 3 or 4 years ago, we recognized, you know, we should consider their risk to commit future crimes in making a decision about whether they should be sent back to prison or put in a program. And that has resulted in fewer of those offenders kind of churning through the system unnecessarily.
It's so interesting to me because what you're talking about is, as you say, evidence. And yet this is an arena in American life where that doesn't always hold sway. It's emotional, and understandably so, for the victims of crime and for the families of crime victims. How do you think that argument is playing out? I mean, do you think that there is more, just a deeper fundamental understanding of fact versus emotion?
Well, a couple things have taken place at the same time. One is that 15 years ago, crime was high, And if you asked people, Californians, what are the most important issues to you, crime would have been in the top two or three. And so that had every politician was concerned about their constituents' concerns. Crime has gone down steadily over 15 years. Now, crime and punishment barely make the top 10 in voters' concerns. And so that has taken some of the emotion out. And at the same time, politicians have grown in their own knowledge base about crime and punishment. So, for example, when I first got involved at the statewide level on corrections, I was the inspector general back in 2004. There was a large number of legislators who did not believe in rehabilitation. They said, nothing works. Let's just, you know, lock them up, throw away the key, warehouse them. As I walk the halls today, almost everyone agrees that there are some programs that are effective. The disagreement now is who is eligible, how long should they serve, are we getting them the programs, et cetera.
And I want to talk more about that word rehabilitation and whether or not the word itself has been rehabilitated in, to a degree in a moment. But of course, the other thing that's pushing on this is just dollars and cents, right? I mean, just as it might have been 15 years ago, the crime was at the top of the list. Now worries about budgets and economy are at the top of the list. And so there's a feeling, I would think, that let's put money where we need to put it. And if it, and it probably shouldn't be in growing our prison system.
Well, sure. The, you know, Governor Brown likes to point out that in his first term, corrections was 3% of the state budget and the UC system was 10 or 12. And now those numbers are flip-flopped. Yeah. And he just makes the point that it's irresponsible to invest all of this in prisoners and invest none in our best and brightest. So, yeah, I agree that that concern has grown. And at the same time, the cost of running prisons has gone through the roof. And so all of a sudden, people are very aware of that issue.
Matthew Cate joining us. He is now the executive director of the California State Association of Counties. Just formerly, as of just a week ago, the Secretary of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And I just noticed this, actually, on my list here, that the and rehabilitation is part of your title as well. So let's talk more about that word, your former title. What's changed about that? What do we know that works? You talked about aging, that aging is a key factor, but presumably there are other things we can do to help people besides just let them get older.
Well, sure. So if you go back 10 years, even 5 years ago, someone comes to prison and there are an array of options for treatment. They, you know, there's a vocational training and there may be drug and alcohol treatment and maybe an anger management class. But there was no way of assessing what that person needed. And so the inmate comes in and he or she would just sign up for the classes they want. And they got into those classes based on how long they had been on the list. And so obviously some people with no drug problems were going to drug and alcohol classes because they thought it might help them get paroled or because it was air conditioned or for whatever reason. So in the last 2 or 3 years, we have instituted, again, talking about evidence, evidence-based assessments for what we call criminogenic needs. What are the factors in your life that's leading you to commit crimes? And most of those are about criminal thinking patterns, but also drug and alcohol addiction, also inability to get work. All those things are factors, but each person has a different grouping that needs to be addressed to change their behavior. And so we're now just starting in California to assign people to programs based on a scientifically assessed need for their turnaround.
And what do we know about which of those arenas is the most fruitful? Is it in terms of drug and alcohol education? I mean, what do we get the most benefit from in as far as those various rehabilitative efforts go?
Well, so let's take just drug and alcohol issues, and then I'll get to the broader question. If someone has a drug and alcohol problem, what you find is if you treat them in prison, it may reduce their likelihood of reoffending on a drug crime by about 5%. If you treat them on parole, you can get another 5% reduction. If you put those two together, treatment in prison followed by about 90 days to 180 days of aftercare, you get about a 35% reduction in drug crimes. So it's that combination we found that works most effectively in that arena. But interestingly, it's not education or drugs that drives most criminality. It's criminal thinking. And it's this process of the pattern of thought that inmates have, that the solution to my problem is crime, as opposed to the solution of my problem is to seek help, is to get assistance, is to go to family, to go to friends. And so a whole new field has evolved around that called cognitive behavioral therapy, the idea of retraining someone's mind out of criminal thinking and into thinking that normal citizens engage in every day. Very fascinating stuff.
And what do we know about what works with that? I mean, that would seem like a very daunting task.
Yeah, well, it is. But you can see 10, 20, 30% reductions in recidivism mm-hmm. if you can change the way people think. It's not done overnight. But you have to start way back to this basic concept of who are you and what's your relationship to other people and what are your what's your contract with society, and begin to then map out for people, if you take the following actions based upon your this thinking leads to these actions, lead to these repercussions. And so you have to begin to align the action with what's really going to happen and what's good for them and what's not.
Matthew Kaith, the recently departed Secretary of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. His new position is leading the California State Association of Counties. And let's get to that. And as we do, let me also invite our listeners to phone in. If you have a question for Matthew Kaith about either his work in corrections or his new work in counties, you can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. Realignment has been a policy that's gotten a lot of attention in the past year, this idea of directing more of the state's prison population to the county level. Not everyone is wild about that, including the district attorney for the County of Los Angeles, Steve Cooley. Why do you think that makes sense to get people out of the state prisons and into the counties, other than as a way of saving money?
Well, one of the things I like to remind people who are critical of realignment is, before we talk about the good and bad of realignment, let's talk about what the other option was, because it's easy to forget that the United States Supreme Court had ruled we were overcrowded in the prison system and had affirmed the reduction of 33,000 inmates. And so that's the equivalent of taking seven prisons, opening the doors, and flooding our streets.
And remind us of what those overcrowding what the prisons were built to hold and how many you were holding as of let's say, 2 years ago.
So the brick-and-mortar prisons in California were intended to hold about 80,000 inmates. And our prison population had, in total, had gotten to almost 174,000.
So more than double.
Yes. And over the course of both in the Schwarzenegger years and the beginning of the Brown administration, steps were taken to reduce that number. It got down to maybe 160,000, but a long way from what the court ordered, which is in the neighborhood of 110,000 as our capacity. And so Governor Brown and the legislature were faced with a problem that says, do we order the massive release of convicted prisoners, or do we do something different? And so in that context, I think realignment was brilliant, because the most dangerous thing we could have done is to open the gates of prisons.
But how ready are counties to deal with, and now as the new director of the State Association of Counties, literally on the receiving end of that policy. How ready are counties to deal with an increased number of prisoners because of realignment, but also because of the change in the three strikes law?
Well, it depends on the county. But keep in mind that I think it's important for your listeners to remember that nobody from prison was released early or was transferred to a county jail. They're serving their normal terms and attriting from that system. They just can't return to prison unless they commit a serious or violent offense. Non-serious, non-violent offenses, you're going to jail instead of prison, and same thing for parole violations.
And so, and give us an example of what non-serious, non-violent, the non-nons, what that means in terms of who will be going to the county jails.
Well, almost all property crimes. So auto theft, commercial burglary. Burglary of a person's residence is still a serious crime. You can go to prison for that. Almost all drug crimes. There might be some conspiracies that don't apply, but almost all drug crimes are going to be local. And then there's a smattering of other offenses that are included. Almost all violent crime and crimes involving people and crimes against people are you still go to prison for those.
And are the counties ready? And do they have the resources? And what are you telling your fellow county directors now that you're heading up the county association about this is really a good thing for you?
Yeah, well, I think counties were sophisticated enough at the time of this that realignment was being discussed to recognize that this wasn't going to be easy. The sheriffs and the probation chiefs and the police chiefs, and they all supported realignment because they didn't want this massive prisoner release. But we have recognized that some counties were ready to go. So, you know, if you go to San Francisco, they'll tell you that realignment has been terrific for them. It's infused cash into the county. The county has used it to reduce recidivism. Crime is going the right direction, and they would say it's been a big success. If you go to Fresno, where the economy was particularly tough, where the jail was already overcrowded, where they've dealt with entrenched gang mentality in the streets of Fresno, they would say it has been a real struggle for them.
Let's take a couple of calls. We're joined first by Angelica in Mill Valley, who has a question for Matthew Cate. Angelica, go ahead, please.
Hi. Yes, I'm calling. Thank you. Very interesting program. And I would like to ask the guest a question with regards to reformative justice. I do not profess to be an expert by any means on this topic, but I find it intriguing. At Mills College, we focused a little bit about the idea of using rehabilitation programs. And I hear that you mentioned that you use this on parole as well as in prisons, and it seems to have some effectiveness. And I would like to hear more on your thoughts on reformative justice, where it would be a little bit deeper of a penetration in terms of trying to change the behavior.
Angelica, thanks.
Sure. Well, there's the biggest limiting factor right now is budget. Ultimately, the governor wants to see 70% of people in these programs, if possible. Right now, we're not even getting to a third of the or 40% of the people who are leaving prison are in these evidence-based programs because there just isn't sufficient funding. So it's my hope that that changes over time. The other thing that's interesting is that we spent a lot of money on programs that didn't work. And so she talks about reformative justice. I can tell you that the prisons used to do things like Scared Straight. Do you remember that TV program?
Right.
Well, what we found is that the kids who went through Scared Straight, who were screamed at by these inmates and threatened, and it would have worked for me, I think, because it always scared me when I watched those shows. But in fact, those kids were more likely to go to prison than their counterparts who were not a part of the program.
So as part of the lesson that you've learned in all of this or that we're learning collectively is that it can't be just what you think or feels right or seems logical. It's got to be based on science.
No, that's right. And so there's a push, for example, faith-based programs.
Right.
There's some faith-based programs that seem to work well, but there's others that you would think would work and don't. And so you have to set aside feelings. You have to set aside whatever prejudices you have going in. And from my perspective, you've got to look at two cohorts, one group of people who were in and one who were not, and you have to see whether there was a real difference or else it's just not worth our money.
J.H. writes, why is the cost per prisoner in California three times what it is in Texas?
Now, there's several factors. So, Texas, first of all, those numbers are changing. Texas, the cost is going up in Texas right now. But let's assume it's even twice as much. Cost of labor is very high in California. That's true for construction jobs. It's true for banking jobs. And it's true for prison jobs. We have highly skilled employees who stay in prisons a long time. They're well paid, but they do an excellent job. So that's one part of it. Secondly, the cost of healthcare in California is more than double the second highest state, which is New York. And so this is an area where the federal courts have largely driven extremely high health care costs.
And you've recently regained some control over health care that had been federally mandated or federally taken over. Will that then also drive down the cost of health care in prison?
I think so. We have to be careful, right? We got into trouble with the federal courts because our health care was terrible 10 years ago. Well, health care is vastly improved now. If you walk into any prison, you'll see excellent care. All the physicians are board certified. They're all paid $300,000 or more. It's extremely good. We can't boomerang back to bad health care. That being said, I've been saying for a long time, if you get the Department of Finance to look at any spending, they will find ways to cut effectively. If you put the legislative budget committees on a problem and the legislative analyst office, they will find ways to cut. And this governor is about as tight as they come. And so he will definitely find pennies to pinch in any program. So I think we'll see costs come down. We just can't see quality go with it.
We just have a moment left, but I'm curious about what you think remains to be done. We haven't even talked about issues like the lawsuits that have alleged cruel and unusual punishment at certain places in the prison. If you were to stay on the job, what would have been your priorities? What would you say to your successor about the work that still needs to be done?
Well, I think priority number one is that we do have to get out of these court cases. We can't have the federal courts trying to run the executive branch of government. It just doesn't work. And so we need to finish getting – we still have 5,000 inmates, too many, even after realignment, that we have to deal with. We need to get out of these healthcare cases, which I think is happening. But once that's done, I think the focus needs to be on rehabilitation. We need to understand that it's a issue of public safety. We need to focus our resources on things that will reduce future criminality, not just punish the people who are already in prison. We owe it to our kids, our future. So that would be my recommendation. And then my final recommendation to the new secretary is I hope your wife is as patient as mine because it's a really big job.
And how is it true then that in places like Pelican Bay where there have been these lawsuits about cruel and unusual punishment, would you agree with that, that there really needs to be more done, that rehabilitation, even in those toughest of circumstances, is where the focus ought to be?
I do. I didn't grow up a correctional officer, so I depend on the safety issues of others. But I'll tell you, very dangerous men are up there. They can do really bad things. That said, we definitely have to try to change everyone we can because 95% are getting out someday.
Matthew Cate, the outgoing Secretary of the Department of Corrections and Underline Rehabilitation, now heading up the County's Association. Thanks.
Thank you, Dave.
Appreciate your being on our program. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Vinnie Tong this week. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.